Student Stories Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. Immigrant kids in rural Kansas balance high school with paying off their debts to smugglers.
You know, they work all night and go to school all day, and some of them probably don't even get that much sleep, and then they're back at work.
And in Belgium, a young Syrian gets asylum but still struggles.
I keep all day and all night on my telephone or my laptop, digging on internet, searching for a house, for scholarships, for universities.
Plus, a classical musician remembers the fifth Beatle, the late producer George Martin.
He had a classical musical background, and he understood what we as classical musicians were trying to do, but he could also involve that into the more pop culture, if you like, that he also was involved with.
Those stories today here on The World. We have three different stories about immigrants today on the show, and they're all students trying to better themselves in their new countries. In a moment, a Syrian student, now a refugee, hoping for a new life in Belgium. But first, over the coming days, we're going to look at some of the challenges immigrant students face here in the U.S. and why they drop out at such high rates. This first story is about a high schooler in Kansas. He's from Guatemala, one of the many Central Americans who fled the violence and poverty back home in recent years. And as reporter Esther Honig found out, this young man carries a debt that would bewilder most American kids his age.
In the small rural city of Liberal, Kansas, a neighborhood of trailer homes is just off the main drag. In an old yellow trailer, I meet a family from Guatemala, and Diego. He's 17 and got here about a year ago.
Yo vine acá porque quiero sacar a mi mamá adelante y
Diego says he came here to support his mom back home. He's the oldest son. In Guatemala, Diego's mom works odd jobs, can barely afford food. She also worried about Diego getting wrapped up in the vicious gangs in their town. So it was decided that at age 16, Diego would migrate by land to Kansas to live here with his half-brother, someone he only met when he got here. Diego asked not to use his real name. His relatives here are undocumented, and he's also waiting for a court to decide whether he'll be able to stay here or get deported. While he waits, Diego is in 10th grade at Liberal High.
Tengo clases difíciles, pero me gustan, like, science.
He says he has tough classes, but he likes them, especially science.
I like the school because that teach me the English.
But there's one problem Diego can't get off his mind, his debt, the smuggling fee for bringing him to the U.S.
Pagué mucho para venir acá.
Diego says he paid a lot to come here, nearly $3,000. His half-brother paid the smuggler with the agreement that Diego would work here to pay him back. Diego says that debt weighs on him every day. Sarah Carrillo, Liberal High's social worker, says Diego's situation isn't unusual.
When they come here, maybe 10% of them have come to join parents. Most of them are with cousins, aunts and uncles, someone from the neighboring village, the host wants him to drop out of school, get a job, start paying rent.
That's Diego's reality. Right now, he's doing well at school, but he says soon he'll need to juggle studying and work, probably a night shift at the meatpacking plant here to pay off his debt.
Read the words.
I'm sleeping like a log.
One of Diego's classes is English as a second language. Teacher Lori Navarro has enrolled about 14 new students from Central America in her class over the past year.
You know, you think you have it bad, and then you hear everything that they've gone through, and then what they're still going through here.
In her classroom, there's a wall lined with stories by her students of their path to Kansas. Navarro says many of her students have worked at the meatpacking plant to pay off smuggling debts or lawyer fees.
You know, they work all night and go to school all day, and some of them probably don't even get that much sleep, and then they're back at work.
Last year, nearly half of the Central American migrants enrolled at Liberal High dropped out before finishing their first year of school. Another 7 transferred but never requested their records to re-enroll elsewhere. They sort of vanished.
With one of our kids that we lost this last semester, I mean, a bright student, a great student, and you could tell he didn't want to go, but the choice he had to make was to get a job so he can start, you know, providing as well financially.
As for Diego,
me gustaría graduarme, pero lo que debo es mucho y tengo que
he says he wants to graduate and not drop out, but he says he must pay his half-brother what he owes if he wants to keep living with him. It means Diego will likely spend the rest of high school studying and working, sleeping just a few hours a day. He says, meantime, he'll learn as much at school as he possibly can. For The World, I'm Esther Honig, Liberal, Kansas.
Here's another challenge facing immigrants who move from one country to another, getting recognition for the education they received back home. That's a case for a young Syrian man who's just been granted asylum in Belgium. The World's Jeb Sharp met him in Brussels.
So just tell me your name.
My name is Youssef Command.
It was pretty humbling meeting Youssef Command. I didn't realize when he suggested we meet at a Starbucks in a Brussels train station that he would have to travel 3 hours to get there. It gave me a sense of the boredom and isolation he feels at the refugee center where he lives near the French border, and his desire not to miss a possible opportunity.
I keep all day and all night on my telephone or my laptop, digging on internet, searching for a house, for scholarships, for universities.
Command is 25. He graduated from the University of Aleppo last year. Amazingly, it's still operating. He comes from a professional family in Syria, and when he was a student, he ran his own graphic design business, teaching software like AutoCAD and Photoshop, and helping students with projects and entrance exams. He used the profits to finance his journey to Belgium. His plan now is to pursue a master's degree in architecture, but first he'll need a Belgian university to accept his Syrian degree.
Do you know that I'm ready to start all over again if they do not accept my degree? I'm ready to start over.
Command is just the sort of new citizen Belgium is looking for, educated, entrepreneurial, and driven. But despite his relief at getting asylum, he's pretty stressed. It's partly because now he has his papers, he has to find a house, which can take months, and he won't get his government stipend until he does.
I won't get anything, no ID card, no bank account, no even my payment per month after I find the house.
He's watched fellow refugees search for months, and he's braced for the same kind of rejection. He knows landlords favor Belgians with jobs over refugees without them. He wishes he could dispel their misconceptions.
They think that we were poor people and we don't have anything. Actually, the Syrian people, they had an education, they have business, their kids are in school, their wives are working, like a normal family.
Except that nothing about Syria is normal right now. Kaman left Syria because he was about to be conscripted into the military and he knew he didn't want to fight.
It's not about I'm not going to fight for my country. It's about that they are killing innocent people, both of sides. They are killing innocent people. And I don't want to be any part of that.
So he set out on the arduous journey to Europe that we've heard so much about. The chaos in Turkey, the terrifying boat ride to Greece, the blur of countries as he trekked north. None of it was easy, and some of it was painful and humiliating. And even safe in Belgium, it's been tough living in the cramped quarters of a refugee center without something useful to do with his days.
It's very boring and we have nothing to do. I have gone to the management many times. I told them that I can teach kids drawing. I'm an artist. I graduated from Faculty of Fine and Applied Arts. I can help kids. I can work. Anything. Give me anything to fill my time. Just I don't want money.
But his offers were rebuffed. Now he has his papers. He can at least put that sense of urgency toward his own future.
I wish if I can start job right away. And I don't want to take any money from the government. What I'm saying to refugees is that I want them to keep continue their dreams that they had in Syria. Having their own business, continue their studies. It's very important not delay those things, you know.
Kaman's dream is to open his own design company. It's a goal that seems entirely possible, given what he's survived already. But his situation sure makes you think about what it takes to start over from scratch in a new country. For The World, Jeb Sharp, Brussels.
Still to come, an Egyptian student faces deportation from the U.S. over a Facebook post. That's later here on The World. Here's one development that's sure to ignite a lot of discussion on the U.S. presidential campaign trail. Back-to-back ballistic missile tests by Iran. The Obama administration says it's aware of the tests and is considering an appropriate response. But already there are calls for tougher sanctions against Iran. And on the Republican side, several of the presidential candidates have said before that they'd tear up the nuclear deal signed with Iran last fall. Aaron David Miller advised six secretaries of state on the Middle East. He's now a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Aaron David Miller, this was not a secret test. The Iranians flaunted photos and videos with some pretty spectacular images of this huge yellow missile blasting out from what looks like a secret lair in these dry mountains. Why such a public event?
You know, I think it was a willful and purposeful effort, even though it was part of a broader military exercise. Two back-to-back ballistic missile launches with the symbolism of actually putting on at least one of the missiles a warning to the Israelis in Hebrew. It was designed, I think, to send signals to a number of constituencies. To President Rouhani, who benefited clearly from the recent elections, don't misunderstand the nature of Iranian revolutionary ambitions and regional influence. And we will continue, not you, to make our foreign policy and national security policy. To the Israelis, we haven't forgotten about you. The reality is that propagandistic value or not, we are your enemy, we are your adversary, and we have the capacity to reach you. To the Americans, don't be fooled and don't be misled into believing that somehow the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action and the Iranian nuclear agreement is somehow a pathway to moderation and an improvement in the U.S.-Iranian relationship. We will continue to act in defense of what we consider to be our interests. To the Saudis, we have a major problem with you. We are competing for regional influence and power, and we know where you live, and we can reach you as well. And to the Iranian public, who turned out in record numbers in this recent set of elections, understand the nature of the regime. We are nationalists. We are proud of our capacity and our projection of regional influence, and we will continue to defend Iranian interests. No, this was calculated, willful, and as you pointed out, Marco, quite dramatic in its purpose and meaning.
I mean, it almost sounds like someone in Iran is just trying to provoke a reaction. Who would be formulating these messages to all these different parties? Conservatives who are opposed to the rise of the moderates in Iran?
I mean, I think it's generally the national security establishment, the Revolutionary Guards, who are zealous defenders of Iran's war-making capacity and its growing ballistic missile technology and capacity, blessed and presided over without any doubt by the supreme leader himself.
This action was not technically about building a nuclear bomb, but does it contravene the nuclear deal in any way?
You know, I think the Americans have already intimated that this does not violate provisions within the four corners of the agreement. So I think the reality is, Marco, that this agreement is such a preeminent part of the Obama administration's foreign policy legacy. In a way, it's quote-unquote, to use this unfortunate expression, too big to fail. And there will be an effort, I suspect, on both sides, but particularly in Washington, to go to pretty extreme lengths to ensure that it doesn't. Whether or not this would include acquiescence in clear violations of the agreement by the administration, I don't know. But at a minimum, I think you're going to end up with some additional sanctions in response to this. So, again, we're in political season. This is clearly going to be a huge issue in the Republican primaries and when there are nominees from both parties. You can bet that Republicans and Democrats will be out trying to outdo one another on who can defend American interests and be tougher on Iran and some of the more egregious forms of its regional behavior.
Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Let's talk soccer for a moment. The next men's World Cup is two summers from now in Russia. Before that, though, there's the push for soccer to clean up its act. Last month, the sports governing body, FIFA, tried to turn the page after years of corruption scandals and now criminal investigations. It embarked on a bunch of reforms meant to make the organization more transparent. One of those reforms, to include more women in its decision-making. At least 16% of the new FIFA Council's members must now be women. I asked former professional player and friend of the show, Caitlin Fisher, what she made of that.
It's a good start. It's definitely a huge increase when you look back to 2012 when there was none. So when you look at the progress, that's big. Is 16% enough? No. Yeah. And in many senses of the word, no, it's not enough. When you think that, you know, research has shown that you need kind of a critical mass, a minimum of 30% to have any type of cultural shift and not be seen really as a special interest group. So, you know, the numbers need to be more, but also numbers aren't just enough.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what is enough until changes come about and you can actually see what happened. What would you say would be necessary, kind of necessary changes so that you'd say, well, this is a really good start?
So I think there's two main issues that were brought up most at the conference in Zurich just on Monday, the Women's Leadership Conference at FIFA. And the two main issues are looking at the underrepresentation of women in leadership and decision-making positions. So that's really addressing these issues of quotas and how to get more women in, kind of top-down change. And then also the second piece being the under-resourcing in women's football. So really the lack of investment and the distribution of resources within football not going over enough into the women's game. And that's really bottom-up. So how can we look at from the grassroots clubs to federations, all the way up to confederations, how to get more resourcing into the women's game?
Caitlin, what is happening at the grassroots level of soccer? Because you've been there in the U.S. and Brazil. How can changes actually percolate up from the grassroots?
Yeah, I mean, I've been part of an activist group from Brazil with my teammates from Santos. We're really looking at the prejudice and the stigma in the women's game, which has been, you know, entirely based also on a lack of resources. And, you know, starting with doing local workshops and trying to challenge gender norms that have been preventing women from in the game. So little actions like that, but also cultivating a larger ground and connecting with other grassroots projects is critical as well. So really building a foundation of these different movements and voices and coming together and needing more resources there, needing more support, needing more investment in the women's game from the bottom up.
Is it at the grassroots where you kind of have the most hope for the future of women's soccer?
I do, but I also think that we need it from all sides and that we need, you know, we need different voices come in. I think that female players and those from within the women's game, you know, it was kind of disappointing actually that the new president, Gianni Infantino, who was just elected in, he was at the conference and, you know, kind of listed women's football on the list of things that problems that need to be addressed. And, you know, within this long list of things within football, as opposed to really seeing this women's football as a potential part of the solution, if not the key part of the solution.
So you really want to see kind of a whole new approach in leadership to world soccer, it sounds like, Caitlin. And you have emerged as a leader in soccer, and you were at this leadership conference in Zurich. Could you imagine being on FIFA's executive council?
That's a tough question. At this stage, no. At this stage, no. I think that, you know, mobilizing my peers and former teammates and others and rallying together with a lot of them more at the grassroots level, but being able to kind of translate and talk and connect with institutional spaces and those in positions of leadership is where I feel most comfortable and hopefully effective.
Is that kind of your personal view of the way forward, or do you think just like being on FIFA is a lot of baggage right now?
I think both. I think it's a lot of baggage. I think I also, I guess it just depends on how things start to shape, and I don't know where I see myself.
Caitlin Fisher, a former professional soccer player, thanks so much for your time. Always great to speak with you.
Thank you.
You can read more from Caitlin on improving world soccer and including more women in FIFA. That's at PRI.org. Firas Alshater is probably Germany's best-known refugee. If you have not seen the 3-minute video that made him famous, you'll want to.
I did this videos to see if really all the people hate refugees or if they are with the refugees.
Firas's online sensation is called Who Are These Germans? In it, he stands blindfolded in a crowded public plaza in Berlin with a sign that reads, I am a Syrian refugee. I trust you. Do you trust me? Those who trust Alshater are invited to give him a hug. Alshater says he stood on the square for quite a while.
I was waiting. I don't know if somebody will come and hug me. I don't know if somebody will come and kick me. I don't know what will happen. I'm just waiting. But then I hear that there is a lot of people near me and there is people making photos and selfies, but nobody hugged me. And then come someone and hugged me and he was my cameraman and he was trying to say for people, hey, come over, trust this person. And then come someone and hugged me, and come someone else and also hugged me.
What did that first hug feel like?
That gave me great feeling. And I was really happy to see that because hugging someone, it's giving you a warm feeling. This was enough for me.
It's interesting performance art, but what did it tell you about Germans' acceptance of refugees?
Well, it's show me. The media cannot show you all the reality, and they can't make interview with all people to show you that there are still people who's supporting refugee, even if they don't know them.
You grew up in Damascus in Syria, Firas. You were among the first people on the streets 5 years ago when the protests started against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. You were even imprisoned and tortured for your video reports on the war. Do you surprise even yourself sometimes that after all of that, you're today a funny guy?
When I wake up every day in the morning, I say, today I want to be happy. So I don't want to live just in the past. I want to see my future. I want to build my life. So that's what I do.
I mean, your videos are getting lots of hits on YouTube, but not everyone likes refugees. And even those who are looking at your videos are posting comments on YouTube and Facebook. What kind of things are you reading?
Some people like wrote to me, hey, Firas, I am against refugee, but I like what you do. And I hope if all the refugees, same you, I don't have a problem with them. Some people say, hey, I never have a contact with a Muslim or with Arabic before. I just hate them. And now you make me thinking about it. I like you. I want to follow you.
So you're changing attitudes little by little. These days, what is it like to be a refugee and walk down a street in Germany? Do you ever have to look over your shoulder and see if people are staring at you?
5-6 months ago, when the people was waiting the refugee in the station just to give him a water, just to give him food and the clothes. So you know that the welcome culture in Germany is still really strong and people want to help. Now it's like a chance with the funny videos to show them who we are as refugees.
Firas Al-Shatir, filmmaker, activist, and huggable refugee. You can see a few of his videos at PRI.org. Firas, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, you'd think the deep ocean would be a pretty quiet place, but you'd be wrong. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Canada's new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is young, he's dynamic, and kind of magnetic.
Many, many people would come up and talk to him, and some people literally wanted to touch him. They wanted to put their hands on him in a weird way.
Get ready, America. Mr. Trudeau's coming to Washington. That's just ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
Marco Werman here with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We're still in the throes of our long presidential election campaign here in the U.S., but our neighbors to the north are well into their new leader's first term. And tomorrow, Canada's young, telegenic, refugee-hugging, and CO2-reducing Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, arrives in Washington for a 3-day visit. There will be talks, receptions, and a lavish state dinner in his honor. This is a huge deal for Canada. Rick Mercer is a Canadian satirist. His comedy program, The Rick Mercer Report, airs on the CBC. So, Rick, Justin Trudeau, he's young, he's handsome, his name is Trudeau. Tomorrow night, he'll be the first Canadian leader to be part of a state dinner in Washington since 1997. Who's more excited by this, Americans or Canadians?
I think Canadians are pretty darn excited. I'm not happy to say that, but we are. There's no doubt about it. We're very excited with the way our boy Justin is doing on the world stage. And, of course, America is the most important stage. And we were thrilled when he was on 60 Minutes.
Yeah,
it's a little embarrassing how excited we were about 60 Minutes.
Our boy Justin, you say that with just a little soupçon of, he's younger than me. I know the world better than him.
No. If you detected anything in my voice, he's just one of those guys who actually is quite likable, despite the fact that he's tall, he's handsome, he's athletic, he was born with a famous last name, lots of money, nice teeth, charming, two languages. So usually guys like me, you don't like those guys because they were probably the people that picked on you in school. But he's a nice guy. I mean, he actually comes across like that, and that's pretty legit.
Well, you've known him for years. How well do you know him, and what is he like one-on-one?
He was on my show back before he ever announced any intentions to get involved in politics at all. And so he was on in his capacity as like a dude that everyone in Canada knows. And he gave me a tour of Quebec City, I think was the excuse we came up with. And we knew he was going to go into politics at that point, but certainly there was no notion that he would be prime minister. So not that long ago, he was not the prime minister. And if you saw him in an airport, you'd sit down and have a beer with him. So, yeah, I've known him, but that doesn't mean anything. I have low standards. I'll have a beer with anyone.
You mentioned that 60 Minutes piece on Justin Trudeau last Sunday. The segment emphasized he's the son of Pierre, his weird resume, his positive vision of politics. Do Canadians share that same romantic view of Justin Trudeau?
I think certainly some people do. For example, when I shot with Justin Trudeau, Private Citizen, on the streets of Quebec City and Montreal, many, many people would come up and talk to him. And some people literally wanted to touch him. They wanted to put their hands on him in a weird way.
Work
on television. People talk to me on the street. They don't want a laying of the hands. With Justin, they did because of his father.
So another thing about the 60 Minutes piece on Justin Trudeau, he alluded to the Canadian inferiority complex, saying, I think we sometimes like to think that, you know, Americans will pay attention to us from time to time, too. When you heard that...
Well, look, that relationship, we've explored that relationship forever between Canada and the United States, and it's something that's often on our minds, I hate to say, whereas it's not on your minds.
Is it on your mind personally, Rick Mercer? I mean, you say to yourself, yeah, come on, Americans, pay attention to us.
You know what? No. And in a previous life, I used to do this TV show called Talking to Americans, which was wildly successful, and I would just go to the United States and ask Americans questions about Canada, and they would never know the answer, and we all found it hysterically funny. But at the end of the day, I realized it just makes sense. I mean, we're only 35 million people. We're a huge landmass. We're bigger than you. We like to point that out all the time. Oh, we're bigger, physically larger, but there's not a lot of us up here. It makes perfect sense that you would know very little about us, and yet we would know everything about you just based on the fact that we watch 60 Minutes. When was the last time you sat down and watched a Canadian news program? It just doesn't work that way.
You know, a Canadian colleague of mine said of Justin Trudeau when he was elected, he is the most underqualified prime minister in Canadian history. And she didn't say it with anger, but kind of bemusement. Do Canadians see him the same way? Like, wow, he's underqualified. He taught snowboarding, for God's sake. Now he's prime minister.
They always go to, you know, they always say, oh, he taught snowboarding. Well, you know, a lot of people who are 46 probably spent some time teaching snowboarding. What are they saying? Like, oh, he doesn't have a law degree. Well, I think you and I know enough people with law degrees that you wouldn't trust to mow your lawn. So, you know, the guy did stuff.
Is there anything substantive with this meeting with Obama?
Oh, gosh, I have no idea. I haven't been briefed. I mean, who knows? You have to remember, Obama is far more popular in Canada than he is in the United States. So Justin actually gets something out of it.
Right.
You know, some Americans might think that Obama's getting something out of it because he's hanging out with the new, young, cool leader. But it certainly adds to Justin's bona fides to see him being feted at the White House. So it's a win-win for Justin anyway.
Rick Mercer hosts the Rick Mercer Report, a satirical news show on the CBC. Rick, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our next story is about a young student, 23 years old, who had dreams of becoming a pilot. Emad Deldin El Sayed decided to enroll at a Southern California flight school, and then his dream fell apart. El Sayed is an Egyptian citizen in the U.S. on a student visa, and he's in jail now facing deportation. That's because last month he wrote a comment on Facebook that got him into trouble with the Secret Service. He wrote that he wouldn't, quote, mind taking a lifetime sentence in jail for killing, end quote, Donald Trump. El Sayed's attorney, Haney Bushra, joins me now. Just tell us precisely, what did El Sayed write on Facebook?
You actually had the quote pretty correct, Marco. He said that he wouldn't mind taking a life sentence by killing Donald Trump, and that the whole world would thank him for that.
And why do you think he posted that comment, and did he really mean to hurt anyone?
So this comment was posted after Mr. El Sayed read an article regarding Donald Trump calling for exclusions of Canadians, among other people, including Muslims from the United States. So he reposted the article and then added that comment on top of that article. When I asked him specifically about what's his intentions behind that, he said that he was expressing his distaste with what Mr. Trump said and that he did not mean a specific threat towards Mr. Trump.
When was the last time you spoke with him? I mean, what's he feeling right now?
I spoke with him about 2 hours ago. He's feeling okay. We are very close to setting a date on when he's going to leave the United States. And so that's having him feel relieved. We're working right now with authorities to purchase a ticket at Mr. Al-Sayed's own expenses so he can go ahead and leave the country as soon as possible.
But for the time being, he's in detention, right?
He is in detention in Orange County, California, where he's been there since February 12th of this year.
Just give us a little background on Emma Daldin El-Sayed. When did he come to the U.S. and what's his interest in becoming a pilot?
He came to the United States in September of 2015. He's a brother and of three sisters. His father has passed away. He was an engineer or studying to be an engineer in Egypt and then decided that to follow a lifelong passion of his to become a pilot. He pursued a school here in Los Angeles because this school where he went was a school that many Egyptian pilots trained, and they became experienced pilots before they joined the National Airlines of Egypt, Egypt Air. And there are many Arabs and Egyptians still enrolled and training in that school.
And his life in Egypt, what was that like before he came to the States?
A very urban, modern young man who doesn't have much to do with politics, life centered around family, centered around his friends, not very religious person, somebody who just did not care much for the politics of the world or the politics of what's going on around him.
I read that the Secret Service interviewed El-Sayed the very next day after he posted the comment. What does that tell us about how seriously these agencies are taking content posted on social media these days?
It does say that they take it very seriously. I think the context also of the comments coming from a Muslim young man who also is training to be a flight student or being a flight student is also helpful to understand how serious they took these comments. But it also indicates to me how the government saw that the threat or perceived threat that Mr. El-Sayed posted online was not really of a threat. Like you said, they interviewed him the very next day, which makes it February the 4th. And then he was not detained until February the 12th. So for 8 days, he was allowed to be free. He was flying planes. He was participating in his class. He was going to his school and to, you know, his home. And so if the government perceived him to be a threat to the United States, they would have probably taken action much sooner before that, or else we could say that the Secret Service acted negligently by having him stay free till now, till that day. Sorry.
What about the circumstances of the San Bernardino attack and the possible concerns about that, or even the fact that El-Sayed was at a flight school? I mean, ever since 9/11, foreigners studying at U.S. flight schools raise suspicions.
Both are correct, Marco. The circumstances of the San Bernardino attack were specifically cited to the school owner by the Secret Service agents when he put some kind of a resistance towards having Mr. El-Sayed terminated from his education. And he was telling them that Mr. El-Sayed is a nice guy, he's a good guy, he's a good student, that he didn't see any trouble for him. And according to him, the response that he got was that so were the San Bernardino attackers. They were also nice people and nobody saw threats from them.
Haney Bushra is an attorney representing Emad Daldin El-Sayed, who was arrested last month for threats he posted on Facebook. Haney, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
As we just heard, a few months ago, presidential candidate Donald Trump said he would ban all Muslims from entering the country. And in the ensuing debate, we were reminded of a shameful chapter in our own history, the decision during World War II to round up Japanese Americans into internment camps. It took decades for the U.S. government to apologize for that. Now we're going to hear about a similar roundup that took place in India back in 1962. That's when a border war broke out between India and China. Sandeep Roy wrote about this recently for the BBC.
The war itself lasted barely a month. It was almost more of a skirmish. But as a result of that, Nehru, who was the Prime Minister of India at that time, decided that the Chinese who lived in India, many of them who had been living there for two or three generations, were now to be regarded as enemy aliens and of suspicious nature, And so they were packed into a train, sent to the deserts of Rajasthan, and put into an internment camp called Deoli there. And the real tragedy is the war lasted a month. The internment for the Chinese in the deserts of Rajasthan lasted up to 4 or 5 years for some of them.
Now, one of the men you spoke with was a man named Stephen Wen. He lives in Canada now, but he and his family were taken to the internment camp in 1962 in India. What did he tell you about how it all happened for him?
Stephen Wen's story was really tragic. He told me that that very year, as a young boy, he had been marching in his school parade in August to mark India's Independence Day celebration. So he had been saluting the Indian flag. And within a few months, he had been packed off to an internment camp with his family, and he stayed there for about 2 years, I think. It was a really terrifying experience for them. The food was different. The weather was very hot. There was no schooling for any of them. But the horror didn't end in the camp for them. When they were finally released and came back, they were not allowed to go back to the places where they lived and worked, you know, in the hill stations of India. Many of them found their movements severely restricted. He told me about his first night of freedom in Kolkata, where they had nowhere to go, nowhere to sleep. A Chinese temple in Kolkata's Chinatown offered them shelter for the night, but that Chinese temple was also a funeral home. And so by 5 in the morning, a body had come in, and so then they were thrown out with their bedding onto the street all over again.
The Indian government has not acknowledged these internments, right? I mean, has there ever been an apology or reparations or compensation?
No, there has been no apology, no reparations. It's kind of a chapter in Indian history that nobody really knew about. I didn't know about the story myself growing up in India. You know, it's something nobody ever talked about, and that includes the Chinese themselves. Many of them were so traumatized by the experience that when the government told them that they would be deported to China, some of them seized that opportunity, even though they might not have ever seen China themselves. And many of the thousands and thousands of Chinese left at the first opportunity that they could find to places like the U.S. to Canada or Australia or Taiwan.
Yeah, so how do Chinese who were caught up in this nasty period in India and are now scattered all over the world, how do they continue to process this time?
It's only recently that some of them have started talking about it. And one of the people I talked to, Yin Marsh, who lives in California now, she actually wrote a memoir about her time in the camp. And that sort of opened up a conversation. There's a Facebook group about these Deoli internees. And people like Stephen Wan of Canada, who for 46 years was so embittered, not only did he not return to India, but he used to tell people in Canada who asked him where he was from, that he was from Taiwan. He never said he was from India. 46 years later, he too came back to India to, you know, revisit what had happened. And it was a very emotional experience for him.
Sandeep, you said you didn't know a thing about this history. What was it like for you to suddenly have this light turned on?
It was really disconcerting, Marco. You know, I lived for a long time in San Francisco, and so I was keenly aware of the Japanese internment history and the documentaries that have been produced about it and the conversation around apologies and reparations. I had no idea that a parallel story had happened in India 20 years after it had happened in America. It was really shocking to me, and I found this out because I went to a restaurant in Kolkata, one of the very popular Chinese restaurants, and the restaurant owner, Monica Liu, turned out to be one of these camp internees.
Writer Sandeep Roy, he recently wrote about the internment of thousands of Chinese Indians in India for the BBC. Sandeep, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The ocean is a very big place, 7/10 of the Earth's surface, in fact. And the deepest parts of the ocean are far away from the world of people and machines. So what do you think the deepest part of the sea sounds like?
Well, I expect it to be very, very quiet.
That's Robert Ziak with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Last summer, he and a NOAA team sunk a hydrophone into the deepest place in the ocean, the bottom of the Mariana Trench near Guam. The trench itself is 7 miles down in the Pacific. The underwater recorder captured the sounds of what Ziak thought would be a nearly silent place.
the Mariana Trench is this very narrow canyon or trough. So unless the sound is directly over the top of the trough, it's very difficult for the sound to propagate all the way down into the bottom of that basin. So it was a bit of a surprise that there was such ample sources of sound down there.
Among the sounds a hydrophone captured was this. That's a ship passing miles above. And this is from a whale calling near the ocean surface. Ziak's team also recorded the sound of a typhoon and an earthquake. That's a magnitude 5 earthquake, subtle but dramatic, also recorded in the Mariana Trench. The NOAA team wasn't just going around to hear what they could hear. There was a reason for all this deep-sea snooping.
It's been known that sound in the oceans has been increasing since the late 1960s, and mostly man-made sound, and this is thought to be because of increasing container shipping with increasing global commerce worldwide.
Man-made noises are changing the habitat for undersea creatures and maybe making it harder for animals like dolphins, whales, and fish to communicate and navigate. But Ziak says there have not been good measurements of exactly how loud the deep ocean is.
So we did this work largely to get a baseline measurement now in what should be, we think, one of the quieter spots on Earth. So we have something to compare in the future when we make measurements down the road so we can see how things are changing.
Ziak's colleagues at NOAA will send the deep sea recorder down into the Mariana Trench again the summer after next. They'll send a camera along too to capture images along with the sounds of the deep. They won't need a bigger boat, but they will definitely need a light. That's not a sound from the ocean depths. That is, of course, the final decaying chord on the Beatles' epic A Day in the Life. Three of the Fab Four hit the same major E chord as hard as possible on three different pianos at once, and George Martin, the so-called fifth Beatle, struck the same chord on the studio's harmonium, just to see what would happen. George Martin's death was announced today. He was 90. You can hear in that chord from A Day in the Life some of what made Martin the fifth Beatle, his classical training. Martin convinced Paul McCartney to put violins in Yesterday and Eleanor Rigby and to use a marching band on Yellow Submarine. He also encouraged audio experimentation, playing tape backwards, sticking microphones underwater. Experimentation was a necessity, George Martin once told the BBC.
Way back in the 60s, you know, you didn't have any samplers and you didn't have any gimmicks that you have today. You had just a bit of tape and a machine that went on. So if you wanted to create something new, you had to be a little bit inventive.
Ivo van der Werf was witness to that inventiveness. He played viola with the Medici Quartet when they recorded with George Martin.
He was a wonderful person and so easy to work with. And one of the things that struck us as soon as we stepped into the studio, George had a real sense of sound. You know, sometimes when you're in a studio, you take quite a long time to get a decent quartet sound, to get the balance right. And with George, it happened within minutes. He knew exactly the sound he wanted. He knew how to place the microphones. And, you know, we might do one or two test takes. We'd go and have a listen, and it happened very, very quickly. And, of course, we were recording in what was then the fairly new Air Studios in London that he'd set up, and this was back in the early 90s. Mm. So it was very special for us to record in his studio with a wonderful acoustic there. And to have George as a producer and sound engineer, and his son Giles was helping out as well. So we had it was a family affair there.
Right, double trouble. From my own love of the Beatles, I've always gotten the sense that George Martin was experimental and playful, but also very, very serious, almost obsessive. Am I wrong?
No, not at all. He was totally serious. And the way he worked with us was very meticulous, but also very easy. Of course, he would tell us things that were incorrect or wrong, but the way he did it was so nice, and we felt very comfortable working with him. And that's a great thing, because when you're sitting in the studio, of course, you know, you're on the edge, you've got to perform. And he was very encouraging towards that, and it was just a joy to work with him. He was such a gentleman, very, very nice man.
Before the Beatles, he had this classical music background. He had perfect pitch. He learned to play the piano, I read, on his own, and then went to the Guildhall School of Music, where he played oboe. And then he brings this classical sensibility to rock and roll, where, you know, you've got a string quartet playing on Yesterday.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about how he was perceived within the classical world.
You know, of course, everyone knows him, and the whole world knows him for his contributions to the Beatles. But he set up Air Studios, And a lot of films have been recorded there. So a lot of classical musicians who have taken part in this film session to know George, not just through his recordings, but through setting up these wonderful studios. And they know his contributions to their livelihoods, literally. And he has the absolute utmost respect from all classical musicians because he had a classical musical background and he understood what we as classical musicians were trying to do, but he could also involve that into the more pop culture, if you like, that he also was involved with.
Classical music, the world is less well-heeled, shall we say, than the big money rock and roll pop music world. Is there going to be something lost with George Martin now? Because he was kind of able to leverage some of those resources for, you know, classical players.
I think it would be a big loss. But of course, his studios are still there, thankfully, as a testament to him. So that's his legacy to us, really. And I think all of us who work with him will have this memory of a wonderful, warm human being who really knew what he was about and was just a joy to work with.
Ivo van der Werf, a violist and a former member of the Medici Quartet, who recorded with George Martin. Thank you for your thoughts today, Ivo.
Thank you.
Medici Quartet there with Eleanor Rigby, production courtesy of George Martin. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Until tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.